So, good morning, everyone. And welcome. So, our first case today is Mack Mining versus the Secretary of Labor. And Mr. Wolf, how are you? Come on up.
I'm well, thank you.
You've given yourself 6 minutes for rebuttal, so you'll watch the white light. I know you will.
Well, thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the Court. I'm Dan Wolf. My client, Mack Mining, is here today for two related reasons. First, by law, it was entitled to a hearing de novo under the 1977 Mine Safety and Health Act, and it didn't get one. At the urging of the Secretary of Labor, the administrative law judge moved the goalposts without any basis in law. The commission affirmed that by a 3-2 majority. It also was wrong. Second, and for the related reason, because we didn't have a hearing de novo, the facts about the ventilation plan that were at issue before the commission, including, importantly, the safety and health issues that were at issue before the commission, were not properly weighed and therefore are not properly reflected in the record.
Now, did the district director make some kind of a record?
No, absolutely not.
There's no report, no... I understand there was some kind of... He certainly had a lot of evidence before the district director, right?
Yeah, the problem here is that we don't have an administrative record proceeding. We had lots of meetings, oral, you know. Those weren't recorded. Those weren't transcribed. We don't know exactly what was said. We don't have a record.
So the district director doesn't create any kind of administrative record under the procedures.
Absolutely. That's correct.
The dissenting members of the commission held that the arbitrary and capricious standard is appropriate for some type of issues is where the question is solely one of the procedure followed. Do you disagree with that interpretation?
Well, it's an interesting question, and I don't necessarily disagree with the two commissioners who dissented for the reasons that they pointed it out, and I think they had two primary examples. One was the good faith negotiation process. And that's not really a merits issue. That is a commission, sort of a rightness standard, if you will, that the commission has said, we'll hear your ventilation plan disputes. But before you bring your case to us and put it on our docket and ask us to decide this case, you need to work it out amongst yourselves to the extent you can. That's a good faith negotiation. So in that sense, because it's a commission-created doctrine of good faith negotiation, I think the two dissenting commissioners said, now we'll review whether the demands of one side or the other in that good faith negotiation were proper under an arbitrary and capricious test, because frankly, that's your negotiation, and we're not really going to get into the weeds of that negotiation. But that's not rulemaking. And then I think the second example that they used were the emergency response plan cases. But interestingly, if this court takes a look at the emergency response plan provision in the Mine Act that was created in 2006, it says where you have an emergency response plan impasse, like, so same thing we have here, but it's an emergency response plan. The parties can't agree to what should be in the plan. There's an expedited process. MSHA issues a citation. That citation is contested, and then within 15 days, both parties are obligated to submit what they believe are the relevant submissions to the administrative law judge. And then the administrative law judge is to rule within 15 days of that submission on whether the plan was appropriate or not. And the commission has applied an arbitrary and capricious standard, agreed. But that's essentially box checking. And so all the ALJ is doing, by virtue of this new 2006 provision that Congress created, is going, well, did the district manager check the boxes correctly? So arguably, I would say that's a version of on-the-record review that we simply don't have with ventilation plan disputes.
Let me ask you this. I'll finish it. Okay.
The dissenting commission members do not discuss a preponderance of the evidence standard, but instead what they do is they discuss a substantial evidence standard. And they didn't rely. I lost him. No. It's fine. And shouldn't look down. And they did not rely on the Section 105D or the APA at all, right?
Well, actually, Your Honor, I think that's not completely correct. Once they get into a discussion of the various issues, they do specifically refer to the preponderance of the evidence.
Well, see, what I'm trying...
In fact, at appendix page 30...
You better give that to me, yeah?
Yeah, SA 30. They say, because the judge did not apply a preponderance of the evidence standard with regard to the suitability of competing proposals to the mine in question, she largely avoided doing so. That's actually a reference back to she largely avoided weighing the relative dangers of the two approaches.
Well, tell me this, then. Is the standard you're seeking and the reasoning different than both the majority and the dissenting members of the commission?
No, I don't think so. I think the dissent got it right. And then, again, at SA 33... again, referencing one of the particular issues, they say it may be that the judge would have come out the same way on the preponderance of the evidence standard, but that is impossible to know because absent remand to her, it's impossible to know absent remand to her to apply that standard of review. So we agree with the two dissenting commissioners that the preponderance standard applies.
All right, so for a completely new mine with a brand new plan, do you agree that the burden is on the mine operator to show suitability?
I think in that situation that the answer is the answer is probably yes. I'll be honest with you, though. I haven't given it a whole lot of thought, and I'd hate to prejudice any of my future clients to that, but I think the answer is probably yes because this is a new operator, and they need to show what they wanted. They need to make the case.
So let me go even further. Why shouldn't this situation be treated like a new plan? Hadn't the circumstances changed by the time MAC submitted its proposal for Panel 3? Because, you know, Panel 1 and 2 passed with flying colors. And in any event, the government says there was no previously approved plan for Panel 3.
Yeah, and we point that out because they raised that in their brief. We pointed out in our reply that this is something of something that's particular to the district that we're in here, District 8, which is based down in Vincennes, Indiana. I will represent that in a lot of situations, in a lot of different districts, you have one ventilation plan that continues. Now, it's subject to a six-month review by statute, but unless anything really changes and the parties agree to a change, it's considered the same plan. So in other contexts, we might have seen this expressly as a withdrawal or a rescission of the existing plan. District 8 required them to actually stop after each panel and then resubmit the same plan with a new analysis of whether it fits for the new panel. We argue that that's really MSHA withdrawing the existing plan, because it's really just a district decision that we're going to break this up into chunks, into panel-by-panel chunks. But to your question specifically, I would say that under precedent, because of that context, because District 8 was essentially coming in 2009 after two previous approvals of the same thing and saying, you know what, we don't like that anymore, that was them that was changing the status quo. I know that Mr. Waldman and the Secretary have a difference of opinion, a fact-based difference of opinion as to whether the Panel 3 setup actually did materially change the facts such that this was a new plan. We argue that it wasn't, and we argue that because the facts weren't weighed against, you know, preponderance of the evidence standard, that the record doesn't truly reflect that. But I will say this sort of as a last resort. Even if this panel – well, let me actually say one more thing. To the extent that this goes to burden of proof, the issue wasn't raised, so we'd say it's not preserved for your consideration. But as a last sort of my last point on this, even if you conclude, wow, we think Mach was really the proponent of the change, well, Mach still gets a de novo hearing. Mm-hmm. So even if you conclude that Mach has to bear the burden, the ALJ still got it wrong. And we still need a de novo hearing. Because at the end of the day, what we're talking about here is the right under MINAC 105D to a de novo hearing, because that incorporates the APA adjudication proceedings, which under 5 U.S.C. 556D is de novo.
Well, now, the Commission relied on the authority granted to the Secretary under 3030 as requiring the deferential review. Let me get it straight. Is it your argument that 3030 is not relevant at all as to the appropriate standard?
That would not be true, Your Honor. I would say that 3030, and we emphasize different parts of that language, 3030, in relevant part, I submit to you, says that the plan should be suitable to the conditions in the mining system of the coal mine. Suitability is something that, as we cite in our brief, the Commission, suitable isn't a defined term in the Mine Act. The Commission has looked to the dictionary and ordinary language to say does it fit the needs of this particular mine? And we know from case law that what we're talking about here are mine-specific issues, and that's important because we need to make it right for the miners that are working underground there. So we say 3030 does actually guide the court. It should have guided the Commission. And we think that actually the recitation of what suitability means in the earlier Commission decision, such as Peabody, was basically correct. It creates an objective standard by which we figure out, is this suitable or not? That is what the district manager should have considered. But when we reached an impasse and it was brought to the administrative law judge for a hearing, basically the administrative law judge now steps in, as Congress created the commission to do, and holds a hearing. And so then we ask, based on the evidence that's submitted, is this suitable to this plan? Where we disagree with the secretary is on to what extent do we defer to the district manager. But if we use the language that the Secretary of Labor keys on to say this is something that's inherently subject to the district manager's judgment and we need to give deferential review, we could say that about pretty much every act of any of Secretary of Labor's authorized representatives for anything they do. If they believe a violation has been committed, well, why don't we defer to that? We've never deferred to that. I mean, I would think that Mr. Waldman would agree with that. Is it significant and substantial? We don't defer to the assessment of the individual mine inspector whether a particular violation is significant and substantial. We have a de novo hearing and figure that out by a preponderance of the evidence. And so we submit that the role of the district manager here is no different in kind than the role of the mine inspector or the other decision makers that take actions that, if contested by the operator, give rise to a right of a de novo hearing under the Mine Act. So 3030 is controlling, Your Honor. It's simply not the panacea that the secretary would have it. And that makes sense. That makes sense. Why would we defer to the judgment of the district manager? He doesn't know the mock mine as well as the mock management. So we point out, frankly, in this case, he didn't even have the same level of education and technical expertise as our management and as the experts we hired. And probably most importantly, and this is an important point that we tried to stress in our brief, if, God forbid, something happens as a result of an inherent flaw of the vent plan, MSHA washes its hands. It's not on the hook. It doesn't have to face the families and say, oh, we got it wrong. The mine operator has to face the families. This is uniquely the responsibility of the mine operator.
Tell me something. Do you think that the emergency response plan cases are distinguishable, or do you think that they're just wrong?
Well, I think they're distinguishable, and I state this because this is not that case, so I have not given great attention to it. It's distinguishable, though, probably for the reasons I stated earlier and probably for the reasons the dissent pointed out, which is that it looks a lot like on-the-record review because it's really just box-checking. But I would also have to say, to give myself an out here, that if I were representing a client in a future emergency response plan case, I'd have to take a serious look as to whether that, those decisions were correct. I don't think the issue of burdens and standards of proof were briefed as extensively in those cases as they have been here. So I wouldn't want to concede for all time that they were correctly stated. I will just say that on the record we have, they probably are fairly distinguishable.
And just so I absolutely have it correct, your view of the record is that the dissenting members of the commission did address the APA.
They addressed the preponderance of the evidence, and I think implied in that is that they recognized that the APA...
Okay, I'm glad I asked.
Yeah.
Implied.
Mr. Wolf, the secretary makes much of the point that under the statute, the secretary simply has delegated all authority over this issue to the district director, and that the district director's decision is really a final agency action.
Yeah.
And therefore ought to be reviewed for abuse of discretion. Why is that not so?
Well, it's not so because the Mine Act makes it not so. I'll also note, as we point out in the briefs, that that flies in the face of the argument that the Secretary of Labor and the Department of Justice took in the Elk Run case that was later at issue in the District Court for the District of Columbia, that this is not final agency action. And in fact, more importantly, the District Court judge agreed and dismissed those APA claims brought on that point. And secondly, you know, the D.C. Circuit long ago in 1976 in the Ziegler decision pointed out how the MSHA district manager, now that was under the preceding COAL Act, but it identical language, said it doesn't have anywhere near this sort of unbridled authority to dictate terms. If they disagree, the operator doesn't have to accede to the demands of the district manager. They have a right to a hearing. And so I think, Your Honor, that when you look at the structure of the Act, it's hard to find it's impossible to find, I would submit, that this is the type of action that is final and committed to the discretion of the district manager. And I see that I'm into my rebuttal time. So.
I just have one other question. The government argues that the provisions of the enforced plans are enforceable as if they were mandatory safety and health standards, and so therefore the arbitrary and capricious standard should apply here.
Right.
You take a different view of that.
We definitely take a different view. They've suggested that the individual dictate of the district manager is akin to a rule, but it's not akin to a rule. The rule that we admit becomes a de facto mandatory standard is the agreed upon plan provision. And if it's not agreed upon, it's not a rule. So what do we do then when it's not agreed upon? We go through the litigation process. And then, through the sausage making of litigation, the ALJ reaches a decision, subject to review, of course, but the ALJ reaches a decision on the merits of that provision. And ultimately, we get a provision that is the equivalent of a mandatory standard. But it's not the district manager's statement, you must do this. And that's what they're saying, and that's so terribly wrong. Because, again, we don't have an administrative record up to that point. So, and for the other reasons I said, it doesn't make sense as a matter of common sense to defer to the district manager on that point. So, if there's no further...
I do. I'm sorry. Bottom line, is your approach the same as that of the dissent or the district court?
Oh, the district court in Elk Run? No, our position here is pretty much in line with the dissenting commissioners. I can't say that I wouldn't quibble with some of the things they said, but conceptually on the law, we're in line with the dissent.
Okay. Thank you. Because, okay. Hi, Mr. Waldman. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. May it please the court.
You seem to have a very civil relationship, you two. That's nice.
Thank you. The traditional principle of administrative law says that when an administrative agency exercises discretion that's delegated to it by Congress, that its determination is subject to arbitrary and capricious review. And the Commission, in fact, applies that standard, arbitrary and capricious review, to various secretarial determinations under the Mine Act. For example, under Section 103K of the Mine Act, which authorizes the Secretary to issue any order that he deems appropriate to ensure the safety of a person in a mine following a mine accident, the Commission reviews a 103K order under the arbitrary and capricious standard, as the Eighth Circuit held in the Patterson Sand case recently. Additionally, under Section 107A of the Mine Act, which authorizes the Secretary, or more specifically a coal mine inspector, to issue a withdrawal order whenever he finds that there's an imminent danger, that withdrawal order also is subject to review under the abuse of discretion standard, as this Court held in the Old Bend case.
Can I stop you, please? Section 105D authorizes review of the district manager's decision by the Commission, and it requires that hearings be conducted pursuant to the APA. And the Supreme Court in Stedman held that the standard of proof for such APA hearings is preponderance of the evidence. So why wouldn't Stedman be dispositive of the issue here?
Because we're not arguing about what the standard of proof is. We're arguing about what the Secretary has to prove, not the quantum of evidence necessary, which is, you know, the standard of proof is preponderance of the evidence. But what does the Secretary have to prove by a preponderance of the evidence? Stedman and the Administrative Procedure Act don't answer that question. And the Commission held that there was nothing inconsistent with a determination or a holding that the preponderance of the burden of proof is on the Secretary and that the district manager's decision is reviewed under the arbitrary and capricious standard. So when the Secretary has to prove by a preponderance of the evidence that the district manager's determination was not arbitrary and capricious, that's a real burden of proof. If you apply the definition of arbitrary and capricious that the Supreme Court set forth in the State Farm case, the Secretary has to first of all prove what was before the district manager when he made his decision. And that is a factual determination that the Secretary and the Secretary would bear the burden of proof by a preponderance of the evidence. Conceivably, the parties could disagree on what information was before the district manager, and the administrative law judge then would have to make a finding on the preponderance of the evidence as to what exactly was before the district manager. And then also, proceeding under State Farm, the Secretary would also have to prove that the district manager considered what he was supposed to consider and didn't consider anything that he wasn't supposed to consider. So that's a fact that's both legal and factual. As to what he's supposed to consider or not supposed to consider, you would go to the ALJ would look at the legal definition of suitability and determine whether the district manager was within those parameters. And as to whether the district manager actually considered what he was supposed to and didn't consider what he wasn't supposed to, again, that's a factual determination.
Under your theory, would MAC be denied entirely the opportunity to conduct discovery and produce expert testimony? Because such opportunities wouldn't be available before the district manager and wouldn't be relevant before the commission, except as to the very limited purpose of establishing that the district manager abused his or her discretion. So, yeah.
The mock would not be limited in the manner that you suggested, because first of all, mock could have produced that information to the district manager, and it really hasn't given any substantial reason why it didn't. But assuming that when a case gets to the administrative law judge, the operator, whether it's Mock or anybody else, can put in evidence regarding what was before the district manager.
See, let me tell you where I'm, having a lot of trouble. Given that the liability in case of an accident is borne entirely by the mine, isn't it unlikely that the Mine Act would vest this district manager with virtually unreviewable discretion without giving the mine the opportunity to present evidence and contest that plan, as a factual legal matter before an independent adjudicator? The district manager isn't an independent adjudicator.
No, but the district manager is the representative of the secretary, and Congress entrusted to the secretary's judgment the determination as to whether to approve or not to approve ventilation plans.
But see, the commission was established by Congress, and it was established by Congress to be, it seems, to be its own agency, independent of, MHSA's enforcement decision-making. And isn't that mechanism for independent review really rendered meaningless if it's limited to an abuse of discretion standard, because all the fact-finding has to be done by the interested party rather than the independent commission?
Not the fact-finding, but the exercise of judgment.
Where do you get an exercise of judgment if not from fact-finding?
Facts. But the ALJ, the commission ALJ, certainly can review the facts under the substantial evidence standard. The secretary does not question that. What the commission and the commission ALJ cannot do is substitute their judgment for the district manager's with respect to the judgment call.
Is that not a catch-22 of some sort?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I understand that the commission is set up as an independent adjudicatory body, but, the secretary is the institution, or the Department of Labor is the institution that has the expertise in this very technical area. And the secretary reviews every single ventilation plan that there is. The commission reviews only those ventilation plans that are disputed. The secretary inspects every single underground coal mine at least four times a year. The commission never sets foot in a coal mine. The commission is purely an adjudicatory body. In fact, the ALJ in this case, at page 20 of the joint appendix, admitted that she did not have the expertise to determine what should be in and what shouldn't be in a ventilation plan.
The commission cited the D.C. Circuit Peabody Coal decision to say it was acting consistently with court precedent. And your position is that the D.C. Circuit applied the arbitrary and capricious standard in Peabody Coal. But wasn't that really the standard the D.C. Circuit used? It didn't say anything in Peabody about what the standard the ALJ or the commission should have used, did it?
No, it was a very cursory.
Right.
It was a very cursory unpublished decision, and the point
was. Three paragraphs.
Was, pardon me.
Three paragraphs, I think. Exactly.
Yeah. But its point was that this determination by the district manager should be reviewed under the arbitrary and capricious standard.
Mr. Waldman, are there any regulations, directives, anything to guide the district director in making the decision as Does he have to give both sides an opportunity to submit any evidence that they want? Does he have to keep any particular kind of records? What's to prevent the district director from cutting off the proceeding at any point he wants and saying, I think I've got enough, I don't like the ventilation system?
Yes, there are internal controls on what the district manager does. In fact, Mock cited them in its brief, the program policy manual and the handbook on ventilation plans and plan review. And in those Department of Labor publications, there are, you know, substantial guidelines for district managers to follow. But it is true that the district manager ultimately is not bound by the Administrative Procedure Act, does not have to produce any formal administrative record. But that's the whole purpose of the proceeding before the commission, is to, at that point, assemble the administrative record. And the burden is on the Secretary of Labor to establish by a preponderance of the evidence what was before the district manager. And if Mock Mining disagrees as to what information was in front of the district manager, they certainly can express that disagreement and force the secretary to meet the preponderance of the evidence standard on those facts. Unless the court has any further questions, I would conclude at this point and
okay.
ask that the court affirm the commission's holding that the secretary bears the burden of proving that the district manager's suitability determinations were arbitrary and capricious.
Thank you very much. 2 minutes.
Thank you. I'll just submit that what Mr. Waldman has just submitted is a process that the Mine Act doesn't provide. He's presented the idea that the ALJ's role is to compile the administrative record, but that's an awfully strange use of scarce public resources. He also said that the ALJ's role is to review the district manager's decision for substantial evidence. No, it's not. That's the administrative review provision. That's the judicial review provision, 5 U.S.C. Section 706. As I stated at the beginning, there's no administrative record here. You can't. There's nothing for the ALJ to review for substantial evidence. She has to hear the facts so that the commission and then, if necessary, this court can review the record for substantial evidence. That's what Stedman's about. Somebody's got to do the fact weighing, and we don't have that here. I want to point out these are in the administrative record. Pages 1 through 20 are the initial pleadings and the citations. They contain every issue that was put before the administrative law judge. The citations put the merits of the ventilation plan dispute into the proceeding. This is what MSHA program policy manual says. This is what the D.C. Circuit said in 1976 in the Ziegler decision. This is what the commission said in Peabody and the CW mining cases. We have a de novo hearing on the merits of the ventilation plan dispute. I respectfully submit that Mr. Waldman's comment that Stedman doesn't control because it doesn't speak to what has to be proved by a preponderance of the evidence is wrong. It's in the citation. It has to be proved by a preponderance of the evidence.
And you disagree with his interpretation of Peabody Coal as well.
The commission or the D.C. Circuit?
Not the D.C. Circuit. I mean, your position is that the D.C. Circuit set out that arbitrary and capricious standard.
It wasn't brief.
And didn't say anything about the standard the ALJ or the commission should have used.
Well, I would agree with that. And it wasn't briefed. I mean, it was such a thin decision that there's really nothing to take from it. It's an unpublished decision, which by their own rule is non-precedential. I see I'm out of time, so I don't want to take the court's time.
Do you have one more thought that you want to add? Is there another thought that you have?
My only thought is that the relief that Mr. Waldman requested is pretty much the opposite of what I would request. I think that, as we submitted, the commission should be reversed. It should be remanded to the ALJ. Well, the commission. It should be remanded to the commission to vacate the ALJ decision and the citations for the reasons we've stated.
Well, thank you so much, both of you, and the case will be taken under advisement.
Thank you.
Thank you.